better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, August the 15th. This is episode 3542 of the Survival Podcast. And as it is Thursday, it is time for an expert council Q&A show for the week. Here's what we got on deck for you today. Dan McAdams and Dr. Ron Paul over at the Ron Paul Liberty Highlights for the week. We'll talk about the U.S. military being sent to Israel. Where the hell is the commander-in-chief? We don't really know. He's yelling at the press, I guess. Andy McCann will talk about balancing training hard with rest and recovery, but not recovery days, recovery between your sets. So you're doing bench press, you're doing, let's say, reps of 10, 5 or 3, depending on your weight, sets. How long do you wait in between and why? What's the rationale between waiting a specific amount of time, waiting at least that long, not waiting much longer, that type of thing? Next up, we'll hear from Ken Daniels. Who's Ken Daniels? Ken's a chef. He's also a mixologist. He's a pretty switched-on guy. Reached out due to my recent call-out to people looking for potential expert council members to try out. I think he's going to work out. He has a segment he put together for us on aromatic bitters. You know, bitters, like if you're going to make an old-fashioned, you take some classic bitters, or I really like a black walnut bitter if you're making an old-fashioned. But did you know that bitters, number one, you can make them yourself actually really quick and quite easily, and two, they are not just for people that like to partake in adult beverages. There's ways they can be used other ways culinarily. So Ken will tell us about. Sean Mills will talk about problems in a septic leach field. Dr. Ken Berry will answer a question on eating meat for people with kidney disease. And kidney disease here is being caused by something that, well, if you actually ate meat, it would probably prevent. So you can imagine where that's going to go. And we're going to finish up with both doctors today, because Doc Bones will talk about getting medical training that's useful in the real world, a variety of ways to do it, depending on how advanced you want to be. And I will answer a question on rabbits. And everything I say will apply to squirrels and other urban critters as well. Guy lives in a more of a, you know, suburban area. He's got a garden, got some bunnies hopping around. The bunnies are eating things that you don't want them to eat. And you got a dual-purpose thing here. You prevent the pest damage, and you get something delicious to eat. Austin Pfeffer is good, after all. He wants my advice on air rifles. So we'll talk about that today, too. Before we do, let's go ahead and remind you guys, if you like the show and the work that we do, one of the ways you can help us out, do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z. tspaz.com. You go there and start your shopping there. No matter what you select, you'll help us out no matter what it is. Today's item of the day is made by a company called Lizzie Q. Like Thin Lizzy, right? L-I-Z-Z-Y-Q. And it is a smoker tube. What is a smoker tube for? That sounds like some kind of thing to get high watching TV, listen to Steve Miller Band, right? No. No, a smoker tube, you put wood pellets in it, and you light them on fire, you let them burn for a bit, then you blow them out, and you put them like on a grill, and you can use them for hot smoking, you can use them for medium temperature, warmish smoking, like for curing sausages, you can use them for a cold smoke. There's a lot of ways to do it. The key is using them correctly, and using good quality pellets, and you can find out about all of that in the write-up that I have today. There's a link for it in the show notes today as well. For episode 3552, and I'll remind you, we have a pretty good lineup of item of the day from this week. We had the Anker Soundcore waterproof Bluetooth speakers, the Kinepex Cobra pliers, the Hamilton Beach variable temperature electric kettle, and the Lizzie Q smoker tube. So all of those are in the show notes for today. If you missed an episode this week, those are the items of the day we've recommended. These are all great items. None of them are new. All of them have been in the T-Spaz catalog for a while, which means they are tried and true. Not only have I used them and I'm happy with them, you guys have used them and you're happy with them as well. If you want to know why I said when I was talking about the variable temperature kettle, variable reach, I had a brain cell flashback to the early 1990s when I was a mechanic in the United States Army with variable reach rough terrain forklifts. For some reason, I saw variable in that. You know, that piece came into my head. I don't know why. Anyway, let's go ahead and hear from Dan McAdams and Dr. Ron Paul on deploying United States troops to the Middle East while the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, is pretty much MIA.
Now, you mentioned a lot of the times that you remember in your life seeing troops and military equipment move. I remember a few times myself, you know, we had little ones like Grenada, little things like that, and some bigger ones. But the one thing that, and maybe I'm just remembering wrong, but it seems to me, when all of these things happened, we knew there was a president in charge, you know. And I remember, you know, President Reagan coming on and explaining what's happening in Grenada. Now, we may disagree with the president, the late president, on the rationale. Panama as well, with George Herbert Walker Bush. But you always had the sense that they would come on TV and say, I have decided to move our carrier group X and Y over here because of this specific threat. Hopefully we can deter, you know, but there was always a sense that there was somebody who was a commander-in-chief of the military. And in this circumstance, the thing that struck, I think, a lot of people over the weekend, including some good friends of ours who I will put up here, is it doesn't seem like anybody's in charge. Biden, Kamala, nobody. Let's start with a couple of things. Now, this is a New York Times article that came out today, if they put this first one up. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin spoke with his Israeli counterpart, Yoav Gallant, on Sunday, the third call that you are known to have held in a week amid rising fears of escalation. Now, here's the part that Glenn Greenwald, who I will read his comment later, this is what he underlined or highlighted. In the call, Mr. Austin reiterated the United States' commitment to take every possible step to defend Israel, according to a summary provided by the Pentagon Secretary, Press Secretary Major General Patrick Ryder. In an unusual disclosure, General Ryder said that Mr. Austin had ordered the guided missile submarine Georgia to the Middle East. The Pentagon rarely announces the movements of its submarine fleet. And again, a highlighted part by Greenwald, General Ryder noted that Mr. Austin had already ordered additional combat aircraft and missile shooting warships to the region. To which Glenn Greenwald, I think, appropriately reflects our own thinking, Dr. Paul, in saying, major U.S. military assets are being deployed to the Middle East as a regional war becomes increasingly possible. The New York Times says all of this was ordered by Defense Secretary Austin, quote, to take every possible step to defend Israel. Greenwald continues, is the president involved? Anyone know if Kamala agrees? I think those are two important questions.
You know, that means we don't know who the government is or what they're doing or who's making the call. And my thought was, you know, this is not our idea of limited government. Yeah. We want limited government, but this is not the kind of limited government we've been advocating. What has happened here is it's an underground government. It's deep state in charge. And even though a lot of that has existed, this seems to be much worse. They don't even have a declaration of war to work with. There's no official war. So it's already underground how we get into these things.
I mean, just to recap how we got here, you know, Israel assassinated a political figure in Tehran during the presidential inauguration celebration, clearly violating its sovereignty, clearly an act of war. And so when Iran says, you can't do that, we're going to retaliate, the U.S. spends probably billions of dollars so far. You can't just turn those aircraft carriers around, you know, billions of dollars coming to its rescue. Maybe the U.S. should have said to Israel, don't do it, stop doing this. But that's how we got to where we are. But now here's a tweet from CENTCOM, the U.S. Central Command, which is headquartered in the region. Now they make an announcement. Secretary of Defense Austin, if you can put that up, please. Secretary of Defense Austin, again, here we go, Secretary of Defense, has ordered USS Abraham Lincoln Carrier Strike Group, equipped with F-35C fighters, to accelerate its transit to the Central Command Area of Responsibility, adding to the capabilities already provided by the USS Theodore Roosevelt Carrier Strike Group. In addition, the Secretary has ordered the USS Georgia to the Central Command region. This is the CENTCOM's readout, to which another friend of ours, Michael Tracy, who I think is an astute observer, makes another point similar to what we were thinking. Hope everybody in Congress is enjoying their August recess while U.S. military assets accelerate transit to the Middle East in anticipation of some major new outbreak of warfare. So again, Congress is at home, taking it easy, meeting with lobbyists, cashing those checks. And if you go to the next one now, this is a map of the region where all this is happening. The U.S. is accelerating the deployment of the aircraft. They're all going around to this area you can see here. And while all this is happening, Dr. Paul, President Biden is at the helm. He is making serious decisions. Let's have a look at him over the weekend in that next picture. He's just taking it.
He shouldn't be disturbed.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure he's planning out some strategy as he lays there. But joking aside, maybe it's just me. This seems bizarre.
No, it is.
I'm going to tell you, I would say that the odds that this springs into a regional war at this point and that the United States sticks our nose into it at a far higher level than we've been doing lately is incredibly high. I would say 70% to 75% it happens, which will leave us 25% to 30% that it doesn't. So I'm not guaranteeing it, but the way this is going is really bad. You know, I've tried to stay out of picking a side in this because I don't think there is a side to pick in this. There was a time back in the 80s when I was a kid, and I don't remember who it was, but one of the U.S. Officials who, you know, just to be honest, was probably behind helping Iraq, but was the Iran-Iraq war. And I believe what he said was something to effect is there's never been a war where both sides deserved more to lose. And I don't know that I would use that terminology here, but I definitely don't want to pick a side. There's enough bad on both sides. There was a video that came out last week. I don't even want you to look it up to see it. You can just trust me that it's true. It's footage of Israeli soldiers openly raping Palestinian women in a prison camp. It's not a deep fake. It's not fake. It's not propaganda. It's what effing happened. All right, so no, like, and then, but if you want me to defend the Palestinians and believe in your bullshit about olive orchards, I'm not going to do that for you either. This is why I'm a non-interventionist. When you see two people fighting and you really don't want to take a side, don't get involved in the fight. However, when we look at this from a proportional standpoint, Israel's taken well above its pound of flesh at this point. It surprised even me. So when this all shit started last fall, I'm like, oh, good God. Like, this is where you went out in the schoolyard and you punched the wrong kid in the face, and he's not the kid that's going to let it go, and he's not just going to punch you back. This is going to be full-on, complete retribution. I am blown away at how far this has gone. So there's something here that either there has to be a settlement reached or something's going to break. We are every day closer to that breaking point. Right now, the U.S. is a factor of stability in the region. The problem is, once that stops working, then our presence there makes everything worse. And so I don't know what comes next. I'm just going to say that I am consistent, whether you like what I say or not about wars, but I am consistent with non-intervention. I want non-intervention in Ukraine. I want non-intervention here. I want non-intervention in the last war, and I want non-intervention in this war. The United States should only spend blood and treasure to defend vital U.S. interests that directly in some way protect and or benefit the American people. Neither of these foreign wars do that right now. No matter what the TV tells you, I'm going to let it go. We're going to move on and talk about doing our workouts and getting rest in between sets and how we figure out that amount of time and why we do it that way with Andy McCann.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann with CrossFit Garage out here in Woodstock, Georgia. And I got a question from Louis or Lewis, probably Louis from Canada. And he asked, rest in fitness is kind of confusing. 2 minutes between lift sets? 3 days between muscle groups? 1 week before an event? Give me some guidance, please. Okay, so I think I get the gist of your question. Where does rest and recovery kind of come into play? really the science of it is basically recover and then try again. So let's take it like a step at a step, step by step. So if you're doing sets and reps, so let's say you're on the bench press. You're going to do, I don't know, 3 sets of 10 reps. That means you're lifting the bar 10 times and then you're going to stop, rest, and then do it again and then again, right? So you'll do 30 individual lifts, but they're blocked up. 3 sets of 10 reps or a 3x10. Typically, if you're doing the style of workout called hypertrophy, which is I am trying to tear down that muscle group and then let it build back up, there's 2 types of rests that's going on. The first is you want to be building, usually, actually, let's make it easy on me. Let's say you're 3x10, you can do 100 pounds, right? And at the 10th rep, you're like, oh man, I'm struggling. And there's a guy there to spot you and poof, you get it up there, but it was a struggle bus. That's perfect, 100 pounds, okay? Probably more like 200, but whatever, just go with me here. So it's 100 pounds. When should you lift again next? The answer is usually, wait about 2 minutes. And why do they say 2 minutes? Here's the thing. You want to be able to do that weight again. You want a similar response and stimulus out of that weight that you've picked and that the 3 reps of 10 or 3 sets of 10. So if you did your 3 sets of 10, let's say, I don't know, it takes you 15 seconds to do 10 reps. I wouldn't take you that, but let's just say it takes you 15 seconds. And then you put the bar back on the rack and take a deep breath and you lay back down. Do you think you're going to be able to do 10? My answer is no. So you're not going to get the same stimulus out of what you just did. If you take a 10-minute break, do you think you can do a set of 10? And the answer is definitely yes. So what you're trying to do is minimize the amount of time you rest to maximize the stimulus that you get from the work, the program, in this case hypertrophy, that you've chosen, right? So usually it's about 2 minutes. Is there an exact science to this? The answer to that one is no. We just say about 2 minutes. It could be for you. Let's say you're just awesome at recovery. Maybe it's 90 seconds, or maybe the loading was too light, right? And so you could go sooner. Then that's a whole different question. You picked the wrong weight. But rest is to give you a similar stimulus response. Let's move out of weights and say you're sprinting. You do a 100-meter sprint. You get done. You slow down. You like take a huge deep breath, a swig of water. You turn around, get back on the line, and you run again. I guarantee you're going to be slower the second time because you didn't rest. Now, how long do you need to rest to get the same stimulus? Well, you're going to get tired, so you're probably never going to get the exact same stimulus because you're working out tired. Actually, maybe be looser on a run. You might actually be able to go faster on sets down the line. But that's what you're looking to do is figure out your own body and maximize the amount of return on the investment you're putting out. So everybody could wait 10 minutes and be totally good. Now, you might be too cold, and so that's too long, but you get my point is, yeah, you could give me a maximal effort if you waited 10 minutes. What about 5 minutes? Okay, well, what about 3 minutes? Okay, what about 1 minute? So at 1 minute, you're probably all thinking, yeah, no, I don't know. 3 minutes, yes. So a lot of times we use the 3 minute mark at our gym because people usually don't like to wait or aren't good on the clock to wait 2 minutes after the last lift. So let's say you set the clock, you go 3, 2, 1, go, you do 10 bench press. It takes you 15 seconds. So technically you would want to wait 2 minutes. So it'd be 2 minutes and 15 seconds is when you'd start your next. But pretty much everyone's impatient. They're going to say, hey, well, I want the 0 mark. I'm going to go at the 2 minute mark. And that's not actually what we're asking. You're not giving yourself enough rest. Possibly. Everybody's body is different. But 2 minutes is usually what people say. Okay. Then you're like, well, I'm using hypertrophy. I just blew up my muscle. So typically you would do like Monday, back and by, Tuesday, chest and try, and Wednesday is leg day, right? And then you would repeat the cycle. So every 6 days you're hitting that, or every 3 days you're hitting that body part again. So that rest is because in hypertrophy, what you're doing is breaking down your muscles and then letting them build back up. And so you're building a muscle bigger and stronger for sure, but bigger. So the key there is I'm kind of trying to make my body look bigger. So I'm not necessarily concerned with my output. So for example, I'm a 165-pound guy, but I can deadlift a lot of weight. So let's say I deadlift 400 pounds at 165. I weigh 165 pounds and I deadlift 400 pounds. Okay, then you take another guy that is 200 pounds, but he looks swollen huge, but he can also only deadlift 400 pounds. So there's a difference in way your muscles work. One is you can build muscle fiber to be bigger or swell, like just enlarge the muscle fiber. The other thing to do is to increase the muscle fiber usage, so you're recruiting more of that muscle fiber. So instead of using 10% muscle, you're using 20% or something like that. Weirdly, the percentage of muscle that we actually use in any movement is quite low. And anyway, so you can get it bigger or you can recruit more. Then there's the other side of rest, which is like, hey, I'm doing an event and I'm trying to peak for the event, or maybe after the event, I'm like trying to cool back down and hit a maximal load. So if you did, I don't know, let's say you went and did an Ironman. You're not going to go out tomorrow and do another Ironman. There's an amount of time you need to like rest. So maybe the next day you just go for a walk. Then the day after that, you go for a bike ride. Then the day after that, you go for a swim. And then you put all three together, but it's short and it's easy, right? So you're letting yourself acclimate to what you just did. So basically letting your body recover so you can then push it back into that same stimulus. Anyway, rest is important, but it kind of depends on what you're doing and where the rest is going to be. The rule of thumb is, if you don't think you can do the same thing you just did, then you should probably rest some more. All right, guys, hope that helped. If you got more specific questions, you can always hit me at Andy McCann, or I take that back. It's Andy at CrossFitGarage.com, and on our YouTube is Andy at or man, I'm killing that one. Jack, I'm sorry. It's Andy McCann 42. And then you can go to our podcast, which is CrossFit Garage, on any of your podcast delivery services. All right, guys, take care.
You know, when I used to train a lot with weights, I really don't anymore. When I used to, and I would be doing sets, what I always wanted is, if I was, let's say, doing five sets of a particular workout, I wanted to need somebody to spot me for the last rep on the fourth set, and probably the last two reps on the fifth set. And the reason is that you are pushing yourself to full muscle failure across the duration of the workout. That's probably some legacy mentality in my head from being in the military. And the Army was just muscle, everything was work till muscle failure. Like, that was the whole point. And there's a reason for it. There's a definite beneficial training effect of that. But definitely, you do need to give enough time in between the sets for that muscle recovery, for expelling the acid buildup in the muscles. And so that if you weren't going to take the time in between the sets, you're better off doing what you would call a superset. So instead of, you know, five sets of 10, for instance, or three sets of 8, depending on, again, the weight you're at. And what I said about needing help with those last reps, I don't care what the number is of reps and sets, I want to get there anyway. So if I'm doing three sets of 8 reps and I am not getting there, then I will increase the weight so that I can get there. Another tactic that you can do, though, when you don't have a spotter, is actually reducing the weight, going in reverse. And this might sound really controversial to some people that train a lot, but if you push yourself on that first set at a weight that you barely get your last rep without needing assistance, and then you go to do the same amount of weight again, you're probably not going to get there. Or sometimes in like a 3-set series, you'll get there in the second but not the third. So on that last set then, maybe, when I say reduce, I'm talking like 10 pounds, so that last rep really takes what you've got. And be careful when you're doing that without a spotter. Don't overload yourself. Make sure, like, most benches and stuff today have, like, safety bars and stuff, so you don't end up in a TikTok video with the bar on your chest. I'm just saying, like, have some plan for that. Moving on, let's talk about bitters with Ken Daniels, a new, aspirationally new expert council member, talking about aromatic bitters.
Hello, this is Ken Daniels with DrinkEatLearn.com. Today's topic is creating custom aromatic bitters. I've had some inquiries about aromatic bitters lately and how I use them in cocktails, so I thought it'd be a great topic to talk about. It's not just for drinks, and there's a tons more applications, so let's get into this. As a chef, I use aromatic bitters in both my cocktails and food creations. A bittering flavor acts to balance out intense flavors of sweetness, but it can also add some complexity to all the other flavor components like sour and heat and umami. The goal is that every sip or every bite that you take has all of these flavors combined. In nature, though, bitterness has this weird warning that if you taste something bitter, it's toxic. So that's why naturally we don't really want to use bitterness in our cuisine. It's not something naturally do without some schooling. You know, aromatic bitters can be quite mysterious in how it's made and its practical uses, but as homesteaders, I think we can learn to make them faster, better, and of higher quality in our ingredients from our own land, if possible, and possibly market them to our customers. So, first off, Retail bitters are incredibly expensive. Last I checked on Amazon, a 4-ounce bottle of Angostura bitters was $23. $23 for a 4-ounce bottle. Secondly, the conventional way of making your own bitters normally takes a very long time. After you add all of your ingredients, you got to shake it up regularly and over 6 weeks before it's finished. You know, with a little food science, you can make your own in about 6 to 8 hours. How? Well, here's what you need. You'll need a sous vide. What the heck is a sous vide? A sous vide is a chef's tool that's placed in a container of water, and it kind of circulates the water, and it keeps the consistent temperature over a long period of time. Most chefs use it for steaks and poached eggs, and yes, there's a ton of applications that we could talk about sous vide, and it's probably better for another expert council day. So I use an Anova Precision sous vide. I actually think I got it from T-Spaz a couple of years ago when it was on sale. I think I paid about $100 for a 1,000-watt, and it's perfect for what I do. You'll want to take this sous vide and put it into a large container with water and set the temperature to 125 degrees Fahrenheit. The reason being is ethyl alcohol, which is what we're using, evaporates at 173 degrees. And basically what you're going to be doing is you're going to be steeping ingredients in alcohol in a bag that's sealed in water that it will never go over 173 degrees. In fact, we're keeping it at 125 because I don't want to cook those ingredients. I simply want to express all of the oils into the alcohol, making it incredibly bitter. Here's my disclaimer for you knuckleheads. Do not use rubbing alcohol or methanol. We do want to use a higher ABV. I prefer Everclear at 95% alcohol by volume. Now, in some states, I know you guys can't get that. But if you end up using more of a standard bottle ABV, like a 45% ABV, you'll just need to increase the steep time by about for instead of 6 hours, 8 hours. So you'll need some gallon freezer bags too. Now, you can use vacuum sealed bags. I find they can be expensive for such the quick use. And if you're careful, you could even double bag the freezer bag and squeeze out the air, and it works just fine. But if you want to use your vacuum seal bags, you're more than welcome to. Bitters are super easy. There's basically a bittering agent and an aromatic agent, and you can choose from a long list of things. I listed some here for myself to read off because I forget everything. Be adventurous. These ingredients, you can do a lot of different things with a lot of different ingredients. So I'm going to read a few of them. Coriander seed, fennel seed, dried cranberries, fresh ginger, cinnamon, nutmeg. Sarsaparilla makes an incredible bitter. You have got to try it. Genetian root, cloves, orange or grapefruit peel, coffee, and tea. Now, you're looking for these intense flavors, and the more intense, the better off your bitters. So basically, you're going to take all these ingredients that you want, put them in the bag with the alcohol, seal it up, and put it in the water bath at 125 degrees for 6 to 8 hours. Now, I can show you recipes all day long, but any recipe that you can find for bitters made in the traditional way where you're turning it for 6 weeks, you can make in this rapid extraction with the sous vide. Instead of 6 weeks, think 6 to 8 hours at 125 degrees. But basically, you're making a tea, in quotations, steeped in booze. In fact, black tea, orange peel, and toasted pecan steeped in bourbon or rum in a super high concentrations makes for an amazing bitters. Add some drops to like a traditional southern-style sweet tea, and you'd be surprised at how good it can get. Some other things I've done in the past, like coffee and cacao nibs. Think of like a dark bitter chocolate with dried cherries. That makes for an amazing bitters. I usually drop that in just neat bourbon. Or other side, I'll do a few drops on ice cream, vanilla ice cream. It's simple but delicious. So look, if you get good at this, this could easily become a revenue stream for someone that has a great palate, great flavor ideas, and decent marketing. Most states don't consider aromatic bitters as an alcoholic product, avoiding a ton of regulations. And I know in Texas, in some counties, it can be produced and sold as a cottage-style item and can be sold at farmers markets. Think about it. Upfront cost, $100 for a sous vide. You know, I looked online. It's about $1.25 if you bought the Boston Round, the little dropper bottles. You know, you go buy some food-safe dried ingredients at Amazon. Let's say you didn't want to grow this stuff. You go to get some labels, and you're off to the farmer's market. An initial cost probably of $250, and you could sell these for $20-plus dollars branded as a local, organic, and any other buzzword that you can think of that the local hipster is going to fall in love with. Heck, I've even seen garlic, mushroom, and celery seed bourbon bitters before. The possibilities and application are endless. Lastly, you should experiment with aromatic bitters in food. Think of bitters in food like salt. Salt in adequate amounts can enhance flavors in any dish. Too much salt and it's overpowering. Just enough and the dish is perfect. The same holds true with using bitters in food. A little goes a long way, but the perfect amount can be exponentially enhance a dish. My favorite dish to use bitters is with chicken wings. It even works well with quail. The dish is called gochujang honey lime wings. I make this marinade and I add about 2 to 3 drops in the marinade for every wing I'll be adding. It doesn't seem like much, but it goes a long way in balancing flavors. And whether you go out and buy some bitters or at your local store or you're brave enough to make your own experimenting with this, it's often overlooked ingredient. I think it can take your food and drink game to another level. I'll add in a classic aromatic bitter recipe and the gochujang honey lime wings with Jack. And if anybody wants any more recipes or more in-depth training on this topic, let me know. You can check me out at drinkeatlearn.com or my Instagram at SommKenny, SommKenny. Until next time, cheers.
I think he's going to work out around here and have some new, unique, interesting things to talk about with us. And I am trying to expand and create some more diversity of topic in the expert council. I have another gentleman. He won't be on today. His name is Kerry Brown, and we're going to be talking about some stuff with him that is more along the lines of like foraging and outdoor stuff. So I am always trying to improve things for you guys and to take things not just to a different level, but also in a different direction. The Survival Podcast is about preparedness and lifestyle design, but lifestyle design is about knowing all of the arrows that you can put in your quiver to build a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. I had somebody email me today, for instance. This is totally off the topic we were talking about here, but it just explains kind of the mindset to think with. They wanted to buy a particular type of gold. It came in these little tiny pieces you could break off or something like that. And when you look at the price, because it's a very small amount of gold that fractionalizes into smaller amounts of gold, you're paying a huge premium on gold. You're paying like a 40%, 50% premium, you know, per ounce of gold to buy this way. And when I said, well, why would you want to do that? He said, because, well, barter. And I'm like, well, how likely do you think that is? And what I suggested that he use if he wanted something, because I'm not saying not to have something for that niche, like what you use for that niche for low cost small purchases in a barter situation, because society breaks down that much, would be something like silver dimes and silver quarters, junk silver. Something that has intrinsic value in the silver, but no real numismatic value because of the condition of the coin. They're everywhere. Everybody sells them. They have a set market price. They have a market price out and in, so you can sell them back. And, you know, they're a way to hold and invest in silver. And you're not going to pay a stupid premium on a 10th ounce of silver, 90% 10th ounce silver, so nine-tenths of a 10th ounce, whatever you want to call it. You know, you're not going to pay that huge premium in a Roosevelt dime pre-65. Okay? You're not going to pay that premium because that coin was minted by the government 70 years ago. So the cost of the minting has been long since absorbed by taxpayers. If you go out and you buy like 10th ounce and quarter ounce new silver rounds, okay, they do have a higher silver content, but the problem is that it costs money to mint a coin, right? So when I mint that 10th ounce of silver, or I mint that quarter ounce of silver, or a half ounce of silver, or an ounce of silver, the cost of the material going into the coin is obviously, let's say, a factor of 1, or a half, or a quarter, or a tenth. And so that's why they are worth less. But the cost in labor to mint it, to do the work, to make the coin, is the same. So it costs a person just as much to make 10 tenth ounces of silver, the mint actually doing the work. It takes as much effort for them to make 10 one-tenth ounces as to make 1 ounce. So that 10th ounce silver coin is going to sell at a premium, where that 1 ounce silver coin is a fairly standard thing and is going to sell at a fairly consistent market rate. So if you're looking to get into those fractional denominations, then, you know, we have these government issued, well-known, not worth faking. That's the thing. They're not even worth trying to fake or counterfeit, unlike modern silver. You have to be careful who you buy from, because there's a lot of counterfeit silver out there. So we have that known purity, we have that known market, etc., and we don't pay a stupid premium on it. And this comes back to where I started with the idea of, you know, understanding something like how to make your own bitters, how to cook, how to forage. All of these are things that live up to the show credo. Live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. So what I told this individual today, by the time it was several emails back and forth trying to help them out, you know, which one of these things does something good for you, even if we don't end up in the apocalypse that you are thinking of? Because we probably won't. Right? Like, every time society's completely broken down, it's never looked like the movies about it. It's never looked like the books about it. The idea that you're going to be long-term buying and trading and selling things for a little flecks of gold out of some product, the person has no way to even verify is legitimate. Right? What makes the coinage concept is that the person can verify. Like, I'm looking at a 1930, you know, silver dime. I know what it is. As far as how much may be eroded off, we get to that. I mean, the cheapest scale on the planet can tell you what the value of it is. You know, it's 90% of whatever the weight is. And so I think that we're more likely, if we did have a short duration thing, that the currency of choice would probably be silver and junk silver. And gold, I mean, you're talking about you're buying cars or something, right? And that's part of gold's problem. But again, I'm back to this method of thinking is what I try to permeate everything we do with. I don't want you to put a garden in just because if inflation keeps going the way that it is and you lose your job, you'll be able to feed yourself better than if you didn't have a garden. I want you to do it because of that, but that's not the only reason I want you to do it. I want you to do it because it's good to garden right now while things are good. I want everything that way, because the only reason it's called a survival podcast is because it's a hell of a lot more marketable than the lifestyle design podcast, because that's what we're really teaching you how to do here, is design your life in a meaningful and resilient and purpose-built way. Because if you don't design your life, guess who's going to design your life for you? Somebody else. And that would be the people you don't want doing it. Next up, let's hear from Sean Mills on dealing with problems in a septic leach field.
Hey everybody, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got a question from Steve that's a little bit different than the ones I normally answer. The question is, how can I identify and locate problems in the leach field of my septic system? Here's the details. Recently, while moving rocks and clay to build another garden, I thought I had an unknown water line as water was gushing out. The smell told me it was otherwise. I believe it's part of the leach field. Slowly, the pressure reduced, but water continued to come out. I also discovered old clay/ceramic pipes used for drainage. I did not believe I would hit a drain line as I was about 80 feet from the septic tank. When I moved in over 15 years ago, I noticed persistent standing water below the grade of the leach field, which worsened during the rainy season. Water has a hard time leaving the land here. A few years ago, I began to see standing water forming directly over the leach field, creating small puddles that my ducks and chickens drank from. My house was built in 1968 and is on a slope property with a 1-to-5 ratio. The terrain is very rocky with red dirt and clay, requiring a skid steer for any dirt work. Additionally, the area is hard to dig deeper than 2 feet due to solid limestone, which protrudes in some areas. When I built the fence, I had to core drill some holes. The old pipe I hit was no deeper than a foot. Years ago, I placed my chicken, duck, and turkey coops over the leach field to avoid issues from planting gardens or trees. Is there a way to resolve leach field problems without completely redoing the septic system? With the water gushing out, I need to understand what causes leach field problems and how to locate them. I have included pictures and video for reference. Well, Steve, this is not specifically my area of expertise, but having my own septic tank that I've had to
deal with over the years, as well as doing a lot of research when we developed the vermicomposting toilet system. You know, we really wanted to understand how the septic worked so that we were making sure we were, you know, developing a better system. So here's what I would say. The fact that the water was rushing out when you hit the pipe indicates that you've got some obviously built up water pressure in the leach field, and you really shouldn't have that. Now, that could be a function of the slope of the land, but it's probably time to get your septic tank pumped out. In addition, one of the ways that you can kind of manage that leach field, especially in an area where you don't have a ton of seepage area. Like you said, you've got limestone down 2 feet, so the water is not going to percolate through the soil like it would in a lot of other places. So that means that you really do need to make sure that your leach field is properly maintained. You don't have roots in there, you don't have clogs in there, because you want access to all of your drainage pipes in order to make sure you're spreading that effluent out over the property, you know, based on the calculations that were done back in 1968. Now, I will say, even a well-maintained septic system and leach field is typically only going to have about a 30 or 40 year shelf life. So you may just be running up against the fact that your system, which theoretically it's at least 15 years old if you bought the house 15 years ago, but potentially it's much older than that. You might just be running up against the fact that it's time to get that drain field redone. And so, you know, hoping that that's not the case, a couple of things that you can do. Like I said, number one, go ahead and have that septic tank pumped out. If it's full and you're getting essentially pressure on the lines because you have a full water tank pushing on the leach or drain lines rather, then you want to address that. Okay. That's going to do a couple things. It's going to create a significantly large buffer for your water usage. Because, you know, if you haven't gotten that cleaned out in a while, there's probably a significant amount of sludge in the bottom, meaning you don't have as much room for water, right? So getting that pumped out is probably one of the first steps. Then you want to make sure that your drain lines are clean. And so typically the way you do that is you get what's called a sewer jetter and you attach that to your pressure washer. You can look this up online. You're going to want to get to both ends of your drain field pipes. So your system might be new enough where there's actually a distribution box before the drain field, or it might not be. It might essentially just be coming straight out of a secondary chamber on the septic tank. And so you're going to want to get to both ends, if at all possible, definitely to, you know, the down outboard ends, and you want to run that sewer jetter through. That's going to bust up any, clogs. And of course, you know, clogs can be formed just by sludge getting into the pipes. It can be formed by small cracks in the pipe letting, you know, you mentioned you have clay in your soil. So that building up over time, oils, all kinds of different things can cause clogs. But you want to run that through there. You also want to run a root auger through there. And so a root auger is going to basically cut up roots that have definitely, I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about this. If you haven't done this, which I assume if you had, you would have put that into your notes. If you haven't augered out your drain field or have someone do that for you, then you absolutely are going to have roots in there. So you water jet it, then you auger it, and then you water jet it again. Okay, and doing those things along with pumping the septic tank out should probably get you several more years. If your leach field needs to be redone, you can probably still remediate that and get a few more years out of it before you have to get those lines dug up and replaced. And then the other thing that is good once you do these other remediation tasks is to reduce water usage. So if you can reduce the amount of water that's going into the septic tank, whether through just using less water or, my favorite, taking things like gray water and keeping them out of your septic tank. What that does is it reduces the water load around the leach field, which of course means that that soil can uptake more water when you, you know, water that's coming from, for example, your dishwasher and your toilet and your shower, right? So if you can take things like wash water and sink water and things like that and not have them go into the septic tank. And again, that's not strictly legal everywhere. I'm just telling you, the less water you put in there, the less saturated the soil around the drain field is going to be, which means you can get more of the water that you want going in there, and less of the water that doesn't necessarily have to go there. So, for example, at my house, the only two things that go to the septic tank are the kitchen sink and the toilet. That's it. Everything else goes to a gray water system, and I'm probably going to end up putting the kitchen sink onto a gray water system, but I'm going to have to do a few things to kind of pre-treat that water and pre-filter it before it goes in, just because of the nature of kitchen sinks having food particles and stuff like that. But that's how we handle it at our house, and we have no septic problems after, you know, having to have it pumped out about 10 years ago, and our septic system is still in great shape because we just don't put that much stuff in there, and that results in the soil in that drain area being readily able to accept anything that goes in there. So, you know, on the cheap end, you can auger and pressure jet those drain field pipes out to help with the problem and reduce the amount of water that's going into the system. But it sounds like you're probably coming up on the time to, you know, sell the house and make that drained that drain field problem someone else's issue, or have it redone. So, hey, thanks for getting the question in. Y'all keep getting them into Jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
Good stuff from Sean, and as with most of his answers, there's no need for me to add anything. Let's move on and talk about kidneys and having kidney damage and how that affects, you know, how much meat you should or should not be consuming with Dr. Ken Berry.
Hey, Jack and the TSP crew. This is Dr. Ken Berry today answering a question from Stella. Question for Dr. Berry. How does a person with weaker kidneys, a 67-year-old male with recent acute kidney injury, successfully remain keto carnivore and not burdening the kidneys? So Stella's dad has been a diabetic for 15 years. That's what has caused his chronic kidney disease. Having some success getting him to eat mostly meat, fish, and cheese. So some success, meaning that he also eats other crap. He went to the ER recently and was diagnosed with an acute kidney injury. They had to remove 2 liters of fluid from his bladder. So his prostate got enlarged and basically obstructed his urinary flow. This can back up in the kidneys and actually cause an acute kidney injury, and that's most likely what caused his acute kidney injury, is the BPH cut off the flow of urine, and that backed up into his kidneys. So there's this very common myth that animal protein or animal fat is hard on human kidneys, or that it will damage human kidneys. There is not a shred of truth to this. This is completely and utterly false. Animal protein, animal meat, animal fat is good for your dad's kidneys, Stella. It's not bad for his kidneys. It doesn't stress his kidneys. It doesn't overwork his kidneys. All of that stuff is completely untrue. Get your dad to eat as low carb as he possibly can. This will reverse his diabetes, which will protect his kidney function. This acute kidney injury is going to resolve, and he needs to be eating a proper human diet now and for the rest of his life. Hope this helps. This is Dr. Berry. Talk to you guys next time.
You know, it gets kind of maddening to me how entrenched this mindset is. You know, you have bad kidneys. Well, you got to eat high carb, you know, and the person that has the kidney problem has been eating high carb their whole life. So we got to do more of it. I have a very good friend. His wife is, I don't remember what kind of, like, nurse, but it's like a very advanced nurse, like a master nurse or something like that. And there's times when dietary discussions come up with her, and I love her. She's a wonderful, wonderful person. Don't take any. This is why I don't bother. It's not her. It's that she was trained in these medical institutions. And she'll say, oh, no, this person has to because, and since it's not anybody I know, I'm like, nah, all right. Because I know nothing I say is going to matter. There is so much of this drummed in by the system. And one thing I just wish people would just pause and think about, who's training the doctors and the nurses? Well, the other doctors and nurses and college professors. No, who's providing the information? Who's the source of the information behind the textbooks, the recommendations, the protocols? The drug manufacturers are. Drug manufacturers do not want people healthy because then they can't sell drugs. The sicker a society is, the more money a drug manufacturer makes. And even if it's not completely nefarious, even if you think sometimes, Jack, just he should just get in there with Alex Jones and put the tinfoil hat on tighter and the frogs are going to turn gay and everything. Okay, look, first of all, Alex Jones is a loon, but he's not wrong about everything. And if they did, they didn't really turn the frogs gay. They turned them trans, right, which I guess is a kind of gay. But, guys, it doesn't matter. They're not maybe not sitting around like Montgomery Burns from The Simpsons going, excellent, let's make everybody sick. If your business is one that profits on disease, you're not going to actually try to cure disease. Just like if your business was let's make this really simple. You mow lawns for a living. Now, people want their lawn mowed when it gets a certain height. And they want their lawn mowed when, like, it's not even anymore, right? It's like a guy like me that was a short haircut. Like, once my hair starts to grow just a little bit, it gets to where I can't control it pretty fast, yeah? And so when that starts to happen, there's nothing you can do with it. You got to cut it all back so it all is the same, okay? And I don't want my grass that way, and I don't care about that, but most people do. So now you're a landscaper, and you're not even a landscaper. You're really a lawnmower man. Okay, you're like the lawnmower man from the movie, right? That's an old movie. And you have a whole bunch of customers, enough to make a living on, and you're just one person, you're not a corporation. You're not talking about millions or billions of dollars here. We're talking about, a couple hundred thousand a year that pays for your kids' schooling and all. And you find out about this new grass, and if you put this grass seed, all you got to do is spread it in an existing lawn. You don't have to plow. You don't have to do anything. It is so aggressive, it will destroy all the other grass. And it will look like the most beautiful Bermuda grass lawn you ever saw. It will be perfectly green, and it will grow uniformly perfectly. This doesn't exist. Some people say Zoysia does that. It doesn't. But let's just say that it did. Okay? And if you put this down for your customers, they're not going to need fertilizer ever again. You throw some fertilizer on a few times a year for them. They're not going to need any weed treatment anymore. And they'll have that Susie Homemaker white picket fence perfect lawn that they want. And they'll only need their lawn mowed once a month instead of once a week. And you live in a climate where you only really mow their lawns consistently about 8 months out of the year. Okay. And if you do this, you're going to cut your revenue to 25% of what it currently is. Are you going to tell your customers about this grass seed? In that scenario, you know what? You probably are. And you know why you're going to do it? Because if you don't, Bill down the road who's competing with you is going to bring the grass seed in and tell them about it and take all your customers, and he's going to have four times as many customers as you doing the same amount of work to make the same amount of money, but his customers are going to love him because competition. And I put that in there because I know some of you are smart enough to think ahead and say, well, that's how the market would correct it. But that's not how the drug industry works now, is it? No, everything's gilded and controlled. Do you know what the American Medical Association is? It's a labor union. It's a labor union. Doctors are controlled by the licensure system. Right? How do you take a doctor who actually has never harmed anybody and take their license away because they prescribed a medication you don't agree with? It's happened. Right? Everything is tightly controlled. So that competitive correction can't come in. So do you think Pfizer is going to cure a disease that's making them money? Or medical device manufacturers, or service providers, equipment providers? Do you think any of them want to cure a disease? Do you think DaVita, who is a company that makes dialysis equipment, and runs like the small dialysis clinics, the ones like you don't have to go to the hospital, you got to get your weekly dialysis while your kidneys are dying, while you wait for a transplant with your type 2 diabetes, and do you think they want to cure diabetes? It's their moneymaker. They have 6,600 clinics. What happens if they reduce the number of type 2 diabetics in North America, or United States anyway, by 50%? Their revenue goes down by 50%. They have to sell all that equipment. They can't sell it to anybody. It's not needed anymore. All that real estate, everything goes. Why would they cure it? That's why I'm not surprised when I found out all these crazy recipes coming out of the American Diabetes Association, which is also a union, a guild, right? And they're recommending that people with diabetes eat fucking cranberry oatmeal cookies for breakfast. But it's got natural sugar in it. Who's behind it? DaVita. Guys, you can't trust medical advice on these dietary topics, not because the doctor giving them to you is some evil bastard, because they don't know the truth, because they are in a system that when they discover the truth, speak the truth, and teach the truth, they're financially and professionally punished for doing it. The way you get a Ken Berry is he becomes so successful he doesn't give a fuck anymore. And when I say doesn't give a fuck, I don't mean about people. He probably cares more about his patients and his followers now than he ever did in his life. He's so dedicated to it. What I mean he doesn't give a fuck about, I'm sure he's happy he still has his medical license, but if they took it, he'd be like, you know what, fuck you, I don't need that. I'm not going to shut up. But how many people with massive medical debt, medical school debt, can say that? Not many. Not many at all. And by the time they get to the point where everything's paid for, they have too much to risk to lose. You can't take this advice anymore because it's killing you and it's killing Americans. And more Americans today die of obesity and obesity-caused illnesses than any time in American fucking history. Anyway, rant over. Let's move on. Who are we going to talk to next? Well, actually, I think it's time to talk to Doc Bones, and we're going to hear from Doc Bones on getting medical training.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, still the number one ranked book on emergency medicine on Amazon, and designer quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Today's question comes from Zeb, who writes, good morning. Are there classes, licenses, degrees, certifications in the medical field worth obtaining to get my family medically prepared? I'm looking to take medical training or education and was wondering if you had any recommendations where to look or what to take to become more medically prepared. Are online classes worth it to take, or would in person be the only way to go? Thank you, Zeb. Zeb, this is a question that has a lot of answers and spawns even more questions, like how much time and effort and sometimes expense can you put into it? Do you want to be able to wrap an ankle sprain, or do you want to learn how to do an appendectomy? Let's begin with the basics. Start by putting together a library of print and online medical resources. A good library of medical, dental, and nutritional books will help give you the tools to be an effective medic. Sit down and absorb the information in them, and you'll have that fund of knowledge that'll help later on. This is not just advice for the average citizen. Even if you were a physician who's, say, a family doctor, you'd need various references to learn how to perform procedures you'd ordinarily send to the local surgeon. If you're a surgeon, you'd need to consult resources to freshen your knowledge of, let's say, diabetes or other chronic illnesses. Can you believe online sources? Review enough medical videos and you'll get a feel for who's the real deal and who's talking nonsense. Once you trust the source, take advantage of websites with quality medical information. Print out the information you believe will be helpful to your specific situation. Indeed, the first edition of our book was a result of readers who were printing out hundreds of pages of our blog articles at doomandbloom.net and requested it all in one book. With your own survival library, you'll be able to accumulate a unique store of knowledge that fits your particular needs. Make sure the important stuff is in print form, because you never know, one day the internet may not be as accessible as it is today. You'll find lots of good used medical books, by the way, online in places like eBay or Amazon. Some information is best absorbed visually, however. Video sites like YouTube and others have thousands of medically oriented films on just about every topic, including our own channel at Dr. Bones Nurse Amy. Videos range from suturing wounds to setting a bone fracture to extracting a damaged tooth. You'll have the benefit of seeing things done in real time, which is always better than just reading a description or looking at pictures. It also helps desensitize you to blood and broken bones and other injuries, something very important to avoid that paralysis that occurs when you first see an arm that's pointing in the wrong direction. Of course, there's CPR classes, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. The American Heart Association and others provide standard courses in municipalities throughout the nation. Everyone should take these, whether or not they're going to have medical responsibility in times of trouble. The limitation here is that successful resuscitation from, say, a heart attack is going to require patient transfer to an intensive care unit to significantly increase the chance for full recovery. This won't be possible in survival settings, but it's still useful in normal times. Then, of course, there's a Community Emergency Response Team, or CERT. Most of us will not have the time and resources to commit to, let's say, an intensive EMT-style course of training. For many, a Red Cross First Responder or CERT course is the ticket. These programs cover a lot of the same subjects, albeit in much less detail, and would certainly represent a good start on your way to getting trained. The usual course length is 40 to 80 hours. Besides the Red Cross, many municipalities also offer this course. Other courses meant to teach the control of hemorrhage are available. For example, we are certified Stop the Bleed instructors. Then there are wilderness and other medical courses. There are a number of specialty courses provided by private enterprises which might be helpful. Wilderness EMT, tactical EMT courses, their programs meant to teach medical care in a potentially hostile environment. Priority is given to education on stabilization and transport to higher medical resources. So even here, though, adjustments have to be made for long-term survival settings. There are many wilderness schools out there as well. These will offer practical training to non-medical professionals, and it pays to research the schools that provide this training as the quality of the learning experience probably varies. Then there's FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration's Emergency Management Institute, offers many online independent study courses specifically geared to dealing with disasters and national emergencies. Some of them are related to administration of emergency settings and other bureaucratic things, but many have good information and are free. You go through the course material, take a quiz at the end, and get continuing education credits or CEUs that you can accumulate. Some examples of courses include Animals and Disasters, Awareness and Preparedness, Preparedness for Child Care Providers, Active Shooter Prevention, and many, many more. You can find these at training.fema.gov/IS/ that's independent study. Then there's, of course, the EMT, or Emergency Medical Technician Basic Course. This is the standard for providing emergency care. These courses are offered at many community colleges. The course length is usually several hundred hours and varies somewhat by state. This represents a significant commitment of time and effort, but it's the complete package short of going to medical or nursing school for years. You'll receive an overview of anatomy and physiology and an introduction to the basics of looking after sick or injured patients. These programs, however, are based around delivering the patient to a hospital as an end result. As medical facilities may not be accessible in the aftermath of a disaster, they may not be perfect for a long-term survival setting. Having said this, you'll still learn a lot of useful information, and we highly recommend them. It should be noted that there are different levels of emergency medical technician. There's EMT Basic, that's a primary course of study, but you can continue your studies and become a paramedic. Paramedics are taught more advanced procedures, such as placing airways, using defibrillators, inserting intravenous lines, things like that. In remote settings, they may even take the roles of physicians and nurses to give injections, place casts, or stitch up wounds. These skills are highly pertinent in the aftermath of a disaster. One course of learning not yet mentioned is military training. Some of the best caregivers in times of trouble will be those who have served as combat medics or corpsmen in the armed forces. If you're young and eligible to serve, consider it. It's a big decision, but one that pays dividends down the road. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health and good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook. And get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
And, of course, my rant on the medical system comes right before Bones steers you back into learning from the medical system. And I do want to clear the air a little bit on that because it's an awkward arrangement. I didn't really plan on it when I set up the show today. I'll just say that there's a lot of things that I want to go straight to a doctor for. Do not take my railing against the medical system as railing against doctors, just like you shouldn't take the fact that I rail against the educational system as a direct personal attack on teachers. Though there's some of them that deserve it, most of them don't. If I have a, I've said this before, but if I have a yield sign on my spleen from a car accident, I want to go to a surgeon in a you know, like a level 4 trauma center as quickly as possible before I die, please. If I have a broken bone, if I have a specific type of cancer, there's cancers that they have terrible treatment protocols for, and there's cancers they have great, very effective. Like, you have to judge it for yourself. What I'm saying, not listening to these folks about, is nutrition. And the reality is, not only is the little bit of training that they're given about nutrition wrong, and I'll get another part to that in a second. Not only is it wrong, but they don't get much of it. Doctors, when they go to medical school, they learn very little about health through nutrition. They just don't learn much about it at all. In fact, the word nutrition will not be used very frequently in that 4 years of medical school. And you can talk to any doctor who's willing to be honest about it, and they'll tell you the truth. Now, what you do need to understand is, well, how can people smart enough to get through medical school? Because it ain't easy. Be foolish enough to trust this information that's clearly wrong. It's where they got the information from. They got it from colleges. By the time you get through medical school, you have taken some of your teachers on as mentors. You trust them. You trust that system. And the people teaching you think they're teaching you correctly, too. If I got enough people together and we created a school and we taught people that orange was blue and blue was orange, the students that came out of that school, well, you'd have a very hard time convincing them that everybody else in society is right about what color is what. So it doesn't sound too harsh there. All right, so I got a question I thought was a cool one, a little bit different. Have not had this question or a question like it in quite a long time. This comes from Eddie. Eddie says, can I use an air rifle to harvest and eat wild rabbits in an urban setting? And if so, which caliber or model would you prefer? I have a large garden on a tenth of an acre with a home adjacent to a tenth of an acre that has a large water catchment basin behind it. I have 4 rabbits' nests with at least 4 babies in my raised beds almost continuously. During the evening, I must shoo the bunnies out of my way to close up the chicken coop. The rabbits are eating the chicken scratch on the ground out of the feeder. There is only one neighbor using chemical lawn, and that is across the street, not adjacent to my property or the basin. It is the perfect rabbit colony that I did not build, thanks, Jack. Know this, Eddie. Not only will this work, it will work very well, and it is very possible that if you want rabbits as a food source, you need to not kill too many of them. They probably have limited areas to breed in, and if you shoot enough of them, they'll either stop being there, or they'll start going somewhere else. So you need to be your own game warden with setting like harvest limits and things like that if you actually want these as a continuous kind of extra food source. And I won't say that occasionally, even though maybe I'm not supposed to, that maybe I don't sit in September in my backyard with a little 410 pump, a little Mossberg 410 pump, and some 8-shot, and shoot doves out of the air. And I'm never going to shoot enough to like fill the freezer, but you know, if you get a few meals a year that way, it's kind of cool. It's also kind of a great sport in of itself, and when you get good at air rifle hunting and other options that I might give you here, well, you might be able to open up more opportunities to do this for people that see these critters as pests. I will also be remiss if I don't say something and then mitigate it at the same time. There's an old saying, only eat rabbits in months that end in R, okay? Or months with an R in them. And I think that both of those are flawed, but basically what the whole point is eat rabbits once the weather cools off, and once it's really hot out, don't. And there's 2 reasons for this. One, you know, if you shoot a rabbit in April or May or June, there's a really high probability you shoot an adult rabbit that time of year that some baby kits somewhere are going to starve to death and die. Because if you pop mommy rabbit and they're in the hole and they're not big enough to look after themselves yet, they're going to starve. So we just generally, as hunters, do not hunt animals at a time of year when they're reproducing. The other concept is worms, specifically tapeworms and botflies. And the botfly larvae are usually referred to as warbles. And what people will say is, but you know, you get worms in your rabbits, and in the winter it's cold, so you don't. What's the rabbit's body temperature? A rabbit's body temperature is around 100 degrees Fahrenheit. What is a rabbit's body temperature when it's February and it's 5 degrees outside? 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The warbles, which are in the skin and outside of the flesh, the botfly larvae, they won't be there in the colder time of the year because the fly that produces them is not active, right? So the last of any warbles in a rabbit will go away, but the internal if the rabbit has internal parasites, it has internal parasites. This is handled with proper cooking, not time of year harvest. But the quality and the ethics are just better in. So I would seasonally harvest as well, is what I'm saying. So you might live in a state where rabbits are considered vermin, or you might live in a state where they're considered game, and they have set seasons. And then if you're going to work outside those seasons, I would still be your own game warden and know the season and know how to cover your ass otherwise. So let's now talk about what you can use to hunt rabbits, especially if you're shooing them away. All right, any decent high-powered pellet rifle will work. I'm going to send you straight to things like, you know, Gammo and maybe Beeman and whatever, your piston-driven 177 or 22 caliber. That's a personal choice. Both of them are more than adequate for the job. I prefer a 22 caliber pellet rifle. Pellets kill more by blunt impact and the destruction they do. No matter, you know, you can get some that are really crazy high velocity, but most, you know, you're looking at 22s. Your good quality stuff's going to be pushing somewhere between 800 and 1,000 feet per second. And your 177s of equivalency will be about 200 to 300 feet per second better than that. But in the end, even with the penetration, if you think about a 177 caliber pellet, it's pretty small. Now, you put it in its brain, which is the best place for it to go. Yeah, but what we're really doing is we want to drive impact. It is kinetic transfer that we're looking to do the real killing here. And so I like a 22 caliber pellet, and I like either a rounded dome or a flat, because it's going to do more of that kinetic transfer. There's plenty of penetration there for a rabbit. But if you have to take, let's say, a cross lung shot, a pointed pellet's going to be more like a dart going through, and a flat point is going to really disturb organs as it penetrates and delivers that kinetic transfer. And in the head, a 900 foot per second 22 caliber pellet is a sledgehammer to something the size of a rabbit. Think about the size of the head. So if I was going to buy a piston Gammo air rifle right now, I would go straight to looking at a model called the Swarm Maxim, SWARMMAXXIMG2. Okay, and they make them in 22 and 177. There's links to everything I'm going to mention today in my show notes underneath my segment. I would go to the 22. The reason I would go to this is Gammo makes about the best affordable. This doesn't sound like you want to invest $1,000 in an air rifle here, right? $150, $200, right? In that range, Gammo is probably your best consistent producer. Their guns are not top of the line perfect air rifles. They're also not $1,000 and up. Okay, they're $150 to $200, right? And they're about as good as you're going to get in that price range. The G2, though, the Maxim G2, Swarm Maxim G2, comes with a magazine that holds 10 pellets in either caliber. And when you break the barrel, it pops in kind of like a revolver cylinder, right where the barrel breaks. So each time you work that barrel and close it, you feed one pellet in. So you get 10 shots before you have to reload. You can get an extra magazine, and that means that a lot of times when you're out shooting like this, no matter how much we try to make sure it's a one-shot kill, we end up having to do follow-up shots. And when you're trying to like individually feed a pellet on that follow-up shot, and they don't cost that much more than a single shot. So to me, there's just a lot more flexibility there. If you want to go to another level, and not break the bank. Gammo came out with about 2 years ago, and I'm really thinking about buying one of these. And when I say the name of it, you might be thinking it's like one of the air crossbows or something. It's not. I don't know why they came out with the name that they did for it, but it's called the Gammo Arrow. And it's a multi-shot 22 caliber PCP air rifle. Pre-charged pneumatic, basically. And the way these work, they use a pump that looks like a bicycle. Like, there's special compressors. Dive shops can fill cylinders for them and all. But if you don't want to spend a ton of money, this thing costs about $220, and you can get a pump that looks like a bicycle pump. But a bicycle pump will not effing do this. You're talking over 3,000 PSI of pressure inside the cylinders of these pre-charged pneumatics. Some of them are up over 4,000. The Gammo Arrow is in the 3,000 range. So it's a multi-stage pump, and that allows it to handle these higher pressures. It has the proper fitting for a PCP pneumatic rifle as well. And once these are filled up, I think the Arrow can do something like 30 shots before you have to refill the air. And they are just damn good at what they do. Some of the better PCPs that are up in like the 357 caliber and 50 caliber can literally take big game. This one is nowhere near that powerful, but you know, the 22, you're looking at about 900 feet per second with multiple shots. I'm thinking about buying one. And so I have links to all of those. Then I also have in the links, I have a video on the Arrow being reviewed by someone that actually did a pretty damn good review on it, and another guy that does like a short review, and then he goes like squirrel hunting, like ground squirrels in the desert with it. And so you get to see its knockdown power, which is quite impressive. I have links to both of those. The other thing I would say, and I can't tell based on where you live and your description of it, but it sounds like you got a small lot, neighborhood, but like you're alone. And I don't know if you're going to have any problem with Karens or anything. And if you do, but it's legal to shoot an air rifle, you've heard my story about telling the police officer lady, go away. You can't write me a ticket for this. And if you want to, go ahead and I'll go to court and beat it. And there was nothing she could do because I wasn't doing anything illegal. And just because a cop doesn't like it doesn't mean they can stop you from doing it. So if you're in that situation, you may want to stick to one of these air rifle options. If you're in an area where you can shoot a 22, like a regular gun 22, with how quick you can get suppressors now, you may want to consider, especially if you already own one, using a 22 like a Ruger 10-22 or something like that, with subsonic or shorts or Calibre ammo, and using a suppressor. I have a video today of a couple different examples of subsonics being shot from suppressed 22s. The second one in the link set that I have set up for you guys today, the guy's shooting steel, and the impact of the steel is louder than the discharge. I would say in many instances, a subsonic or 22 short, which will be subsonic, from the right suppressor with the right rifle, a piston-driven air rifle is actually louder, or at least as loud. So from a quiet standpoint and an effectiveness standpoint, a subsonic 22 in the head of a rabbit is more effective because the projectile, while not moving really much faster, honestly, is much heavier. And that, you know, you're probably looking with, you know, most of your subsonics, they do have a, you know, not usually a 40 grain bullet. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. When you're looking at your shorts, you're usually not looking at a 40-grain bullet. When you're looking at a subsonic, you're looking at 40 grains of lead. And 40 grains of lead, you know, moving along at a muzzle velocity of like 1,000 to 1,050 feet per second, which is where most of them are, and you could pair that to, let's say, a 22 pellet gun at 900 feet per second, you're looking at somewhere between like 12, 13 grains up to about 15 grains, somewhere in that range. You're looking at a totally different kinetic formula And so it's very effective. I'm not saying it's what you should do. I'm saying it depends on your situation. If you're not worried about a cop showing up going, hey, man, what are you doing? And you're not doing anything illegal, and you might be. You need to know what you're doing. Then a suppressed 22 might be quieter, actually cause less people to look around and see what's going on, and have other uses, right? That's just another thing to look at. And again, I'm not talking about taping a bottle on the end of a Ruger. I'm talking about, you know, a good quality suppressor. And again, the federal government right now is turning around tax stamps in 1 to 3 days, and in most instances, 1 to 2. I think there's some reasoning for that that I won't go into, but I do think it has to do with the fact that they're worried that suppressors are going to become legal without a stamp, and they want to get as much money out of it as they can before that happens. I think that's what's going on. Anyway, I've got links to the Gammo Swarm Maxims, the Arrow Multishot, the hand pump, the videos I mentioned, all of that today. And I'll just say, I think this is a really good thing to look at is, how can I harvest game in situations where I can't use a firearm, or I can use a firearm but I don't want to bring attention to myself? I think it's an excellent, excellent thing to get into. I think things like learning how to make your own squib loads for things like, you know, I have a single shot 38 special / 357 rifle that I can put squib loads into, and I'm talking something that'll penetrate a 4x4, and it's really quiet. When I say quiet, I mean really quiet. I mean, if you've ever fired 22 shorts without a suppressor, with no suppressor, the squib loads I can make for a 38 that'll go through a 4x4, 3.5 inches of pressure-treated wood, it's quieter than that. And, you know, that right spot, I'll lay a deer out. So I think that having multiple ways to harvest things, and then I'll throw one more little bonus for you in here at the end. I've told this story before, but you know, a rat, for squirrels, a rat trap is screwed to the side of a tree, baited with peanut butter, is a squirrel conibear trap, is what it is, conibear trap. Just make sure when you're using any kind of a trap that is a killing trap, that you're doing it in a way that doesn't endanger non-target species, like the neighbor's cat. So I wouldn't use a conibear on the fence because Fluffy might stick her neck in there. And then if you're going to do the squirrel trap thing with the rat traps, get the biggest, baddest rat traps you can, because the rat traps my grandfather taught me to do with are not the ones that they built today. All right, with that, we've wrapped up another week of new shows. We will have a Friday Flash back for you tomorrow. Not sure what the topic will be because I haven't looked it up yet. But I hope you enjoyed today's show. I hope you enjoyed having some new expert council members starting to show up. I need questions for the expert council. The way to send those in, TSPC expert in the subject line, send that email to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com and tell me who the expert is you want to answer the question for you, and give me your question in one sentence. Then give me details, but give me your question in one sentence. That way we all know. I know, the expert knows, and more importantly, you know what you're asking, and you've actually cleared your mind and know that you're asking what you think you're asking, because sometimes I get questions, guys, and I don't mean to pick on anybody, but I'm like, I don't understand the question here. All right, again, I really appreciate you guys with that, and I want to know from you guys, what do you think? If you need to eliminate bunnies or squirrels or small game in the backyard, and firearms are not an option, and you're going to rely on something else, trap, air rifle, whatever it is, slingshot, what would you use? Send me an email. Tell me about it. jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. TSPC in the subject line. I want to hear from you. With that, we will wrap up today. Thanks for tuning in. I'll catch you tomorrow with that flashback.
They said you should have a house. The American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.